The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the 16th episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today I talk with Keith Tyers, who is the winemaker for Kloss and Chase, one of my other favorite wineries in Prince Edward County. These guys are your classic New World Burgundian winemakers. It is all about the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir, and I've tried so many of their wines, and they're really good. And what I love about their wines, if you go and try some of their different single varietal Pinot Noirs, for instance, you can tell the difference. And that's really what you want from your Ontario wine, is you can go there and grab two of the single vineyard bottles, and they're not cheap. Not crazy expensive, but they're over $30. But they're really well made. And when you go there, they'll point out to you one side of the road versus the other. And both sides bring something different. One is a little bit more power. One is a little bit more finesse. And it's just about drainage and soil side and angle and sun and all these wonderful things that I'm not going to nerd out here. So don't worry about that. But I appreciate that. You want to see that different areas, the wine is expressed differently. That's what makes wine so fascinating. That's why people that are in the business that started studying it. That's why a lot of you guys listening to this episode who are getting more into wine, that's what we love. It's like, wait a minute, it's the same grape and it is 200 feet away and yet it tastes very, very different. So that's coming up in a couple minutes. One story I want to talk about that has been going on here in Ontario for ages. And near the Christmas break, around that time, the Toronto Star did a fantastic job with this story that had been that had bubbled up to the surface about the LCBO, that LCBO outlets in Ontario had been hit more than 9,000 times since 2014. And there was all these recent stories, and it was hashtag LCBO theft, of people just walking in, mostly young people, and not just men, even, you know, there's one example of two young women and filling their backpacks with 40-ounce bottles as staff watched, warned them that they were on camera, but they did not intervene. And that's what's been going on. Men and women, younger usually, just going into any LCBO brazenly. I think it is. Onwards, upwards and onwards. And just filling up knapsacks, bags, usually with your more expensive liquor, because it's easy to find, and, you know, $50, $60, $70, $80, the scotch, the cognac, even going into the $100 areas. And the issue is the LCBO has told their employees don't intervene. And that's the right move. They're not trained to deal with that situation. They're not trained to de-escalate what could be violent situations. They don't have, you know, hand-to-hand physical combat. They're not armed, thankfully. That's not their job. My issue here is there should be security guards at every LCBO. The LCBO makes so much money. They'll talk about it. You'll see the head of the LCBO and the Ontario government will talk about and strut around about how much profit they're making. Well, take some of that profit and put a security guard in each and every one. There was some tweets coming out today, and today as I'm recording this, it's January 14th. This will probably be released on Tuesday, January 15th. News Talk 1010 talked about how East York LCBO, that's in the eastern part of Toronto for people not in the area, targeted by thieves three times in 4 days. One individual LCBO. You know why that's done? No security guard. You put security guards, that number is going to go down. What do you think the thieves are doing? They're looking for the places where security is minimal or none. And they just stroll in, fill up their bag. It's like a game show. You know, it's like bumper stumpers or that game show in the grocery store where you just filled up your grocery cart with as much as you can and whoever got the most expensive stuff won. And by the way, the key there was hit the deli. Just get the meats, okay? Maybe some laundry detergent. who I feel really bad for are in the rural areas. I want, you know, there's examples in all the Toronto Star reporting about the rural ones. And those are ones that make me more nervous because often cases, there's only one employee. You know, I've been at LCBOs in cottage country, and sometimes during off hours, there's only one person working there, which makes sense. You know, a Wednesday during low season in the middle of the day, you don't need a bunch of staff there. Well, you could easily walk in and take thousands of dollars of product without, you know, in a moment's notice. You know, we always focus on jewelry stores or, you know, or banks, but those things have a lot of security and alarms and things are locked away. Even the wine, and I know, you know, the good wine is locked up. You can go to any LCBO, and if there's no security, you'd easily find $50, $60, $80, $100 bottles of wine. Go to the champagne section. Every LCBO has VUV, everyone, which is a rant for another podcast. You know, that's $70, $80 a bottle. So again, to me, this one is very simple. They need security. And not just the big stores. Like I've noticed that at Summerhill, at the larger LCBOs, King and Spadina, there's security. And it certainly has stepped up in the big ones. And in the big ones, like the one down on the Queen's Quay and around Queen's Quay and Jarvis area, again, here in downtown Toronto, I've noticed a bunch of security guards, which makes sense. Because you know what's around there? I mean, the California section, and by around there inside the store, you know, there's thousands of bottles that are $85 up. Not in, you know, Bordeaux, Burgundy, all these sections. It would take you a piece of luggage that you could check on the plane and not get, you know, a stink eye from the flight attendant, and you could fill that up with thousands of dollars of wine very, very easily. So it's a story to keep an eye on, a story to track. I hope there's more increased security because I feel bad for the staff. I'm sure sometimes they want to intervene. I'm sure sometimes they feel sheepish about it, just watching these crimes go without, you know, these crimes go un, I can't even think of the word right now, just go with it unpunished. And it's not even like the criminal's got to work hard. It's not like it's some sort of Ocean's 11 huge sort of scheme where it takes, you know, 11 guys and everything's got to go in perfect order as cool jazz is playing in the background, as used in a laser cutter and you knock out the alarm and, you know, you need a gymnast to go hide in a LCBO box. It's none of that. Just walk in, grab as much whiskey as you can and get out. So again, for the LCBO, you have the money. Get the security, not just for the big stores, not just for the high-end stores, but also for the little ones in the rural areas. Anyway, that is my rant. Enjoy now, everybody, the winemaker for a fantastic Chardonnay and Pinot producer in Prince Edward County. The winery is Kloss & Chase. The winemaker is Keith Tyers. Joining me, it is the winemaker of one of my favorite wineries in Prince Edward County, certainly one of my favorite Chardonnays. Keith Tyers is joining us. Keith, thanks so much for doing the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me, Matt. I'm always happy.
Yeah, a lot I want to talk to you about, including I was hearing interviews. And by the way, your dog is with us today. What's your dog's name?
Kistler.
Hello. And I was going to ask, is Kistler named after the winery in California?
He is. Only because... well, he's blonde.
Yeah.
And so our first dog was, her name was Melbeck. Our second dog's name was Zin.
Yeah.
So with a blonde, we figured I should go white varietal.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't imagine calling him Shard.
Yeah.
So, so I initially thought Monty, short for Montrachet, but that was taken by another friend's dog. So thought of other great Chardonnays from around the world and Kistler came up.
Okay. Hold on a second. So you mean you have a friend who named their dog after Montrachet?
No, they named him Monty.
But was it after Montrachet? No. Was that just okay? I just
no.
Okay, so maybe
we just weren't allowed to have two dogs of the same name.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But,
No, she wouldn't have named it Montrachet.
I'm just thinking that is that is some funny wine circles you are running in if you have a friend who's also, and then someone else names it Petard, and this is a Chasson, and this is Boulinet, and we're all hanging out at the dog park together, and no one else likes us.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Too hoity-toity.
A little too hoity-toity. yeah, I really appreciate you joining this because this is a just miserable, as I'm taping this will air in a couple of weeks, but just a miserable rainy day here on Prince Edward County. For you guys at this time of year, because the harvest is done,
yep.
What is life like for a winemaker where it feels like, it's not that all the work is done, but it feels like a bit of a dip right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like a breath. There's a time to breathe, right? Because we're in 2018, so 18s are kind of, you know, shards are sitting in barrel aging. The Pinots have gone through mallow in barrel, so they've been sulfited and topped. Then we've got wine in tank that we're just, I'm slowly doing some lees contact on and some other things that are just cold stabilizing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the calm before it all kicks back off again.
Right.
So, you know, next month we'll start tasting barrels and start blending and getting all that going. But right now it's just getting caught up on paperwork, trying to organize things for next year, buying bottles, buying capsules, looking for like looking at labels mm-hmm. and starting to think all towards about what's coming up in January, March. Yep. And getting all that stuff organized.
How is what is that feeling like the first time when you reopen the barrel? I mean, is it some sort of cross between sense of anticipation, any sort of fear? I mean, even when it's a great vintage, like what's that feeling like?
Well, you'd always like to think that everything went in clean, right?
Yeah.
Fermented clean, and so you know, I guess it's kind of like Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. Because how it started as juice and how it finishes as wine are two different things.
Yeah.
So when you pop the bung, hopefully you hear the suction first off. That's always a good thing. But then you nose it and hopefully it smells like Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And shows you the potential of what it's going to be as it sits for another, in my case, another 12 to 14 months. Mm-hmm. So it's happy anticipation, but it's also because I prefer not to sulfite my shards until they go through mallow in the spring.
Yep.
It's also a quick nose because you don't want to get too much oxygen in there. And hopefully you don't see any floors or anything like that starting. So it's always fun, but I mean, this is the time. Let's see, it's end of November. So, shards have been in barrel for at least 2 months now. So now you get to start to see what the new oak treatment and what it's going to do on the wine.
Yep.
And kind of how those parameters and things are going to start to evolve, what the contribution is to it. So it's kind of like, how do you describe it? It's kind of like, it's kind of like having a Lego set, right?
Oh, okay.
And the instructions say it's one way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then 2 months later, you open it up to be surprised about how things have actually evolved and changed, much like a Lego set does. You know,
yeah, okay.
you take this part out, put a new piece in there, so on and so forth.
And then so it's
kind of like that. It's
okay.
I mean, it's probably a rudimentary way to think about it or a kid way to think about it, but it's kind of one of those things that's always evolving and always changing. And
who doesn't like Lego?
Well, exactly.
I'm curious, and I want to talk a lot about you and your journey. And some harrowing tales from some harrowing vintages that I heard in an interview you did. But when I was talking with James over at Long Dog, he said the same thing about just prefers to steer away from sulfites as much as pot, like just sulfiting the wine. I just want to know, and also just for especially listeners that maybe aren't hardcore into the viticulture, vinification
sure.
of wine, just why you make that choice.
Well, we have to add sulfite, right? Mm-hmm. Sulfur is a natural part of the fermentation process.
Yeah.
It happens naturally. But the extra addition of it, I'm a firm believer, you only need enough to stabilize your wine. And if you can meet a happy medium, I figure what it does is it, over time, allows the wine to evolve and get to those tertiary aromas and all the things that you look for in an aged shard later on down the road. And I think, you know, I'm very fortunate that the cellars where the wines are being aged right now are quite cold. So I can literally cool down the cellar and help stabilize the wine
yeah.
without the addition of sulfite and let that wine go through mallow or finish mallow in the spring. Because, you know, it's been warm. Well, it was warm up till, for the most part, until the beginning of this month. And now it's started to get cool. But it takes a while for the ground to cool down. So the cellars have stayed warmer longer than they normally would. So you probably get a little bit of mallow starting. Like you can see it in our malolactic test that it's starting to move.
Yep.
But it hasn't gone all the way. So, you know, if we can elongate that and let it go longer, maybe it develops different characteristics.
Yeah.
But it's just a choice. It's something that is, you know, some winemakers have no issue leaving wines unprotected over winter. Others prefer to have them completely protected up before Christmas break, right?
Yeah.
It's not a concern of mine. I think I've got enough of grasp on it right now. Doesn't mean that there isn't a barrel that always goes off.
Yeah,
But for the most part, I think you get maybe a little more added complexity to it, letting the wine naturally evolve as it would evolve in an environment. So trying to be less intrusive and not put my stamp on the wine as much as maybe some other winemakers might.
How was 2018? How was the vintage? I mean, you won't fully, obviously you can't fully know, but how was this year as a wine, as a grape grower?
As a growing region, as yeah. a growing year. You know what? It started off really optimistic. Climate change, global warming, call it what you want. There's definitely a change in the weather patterns. And every grape grower in Ontario will probably tell you that.
Yes. You know what's funny? Yes. Every interview I've done from Tom Eddy in California, Daryl Booker in Okanagan, and you know, James Latte at Long Dog, climate change has come up in every conversation.
Yeah, for sure. So this year started out probably what I would consider to be typical. Having been here for 15 years, you kind of get to see what a, you know, the 8 out of 10, right? The 80% kind mm-hmm. of factor. And so this spring and heading into summer, we're all very typical. Humidity and heat, very similar. What was the kicker this year was we're used to having fairly warm Septembers.
Yeah.
But this September was excessively hot and humid.
Yeah.
All at the same time with the grapes being 10 days ahead. So it just compounded all those things. And what I mean by the grapes being 10 days ahead, their maturity was ahead of than it's ever been. And so we were probably ready to pick. We let it hang a few more days, but we probably could have started picking around the 16th, 17th of September.
And when do you normally pick?
Usually around the 22nd, 27th, somewhere in there. So the last week of September.
And for people who don't know, what's funny, what's great is people aren't going to know this. The entire interview, we will be contending again with Kistler, who's a very cute dog. And my only concern is don't knock over one cord. But it's funny, it's not funny at all. There's always the political debate about climate change. And it's weird. Right. It's a left-wing, right-wing, Democrat, conservative, you know, all that sort of, you know, climate denier. Or maybe sure. on the other side, are the liberals really pushing it for their agenda? And if you can take politics out of it, the winemakers, without politics in it, can tell you, yeah, the climate change is a legitimate thing.
Yeah, it's the extremes, right? It's no longer are we getting warmer? Are we getting colder? Mm-hmm. It's the extremes that we're getting, right? The storms and the rain and all those things are more dramatic than I remember them, A, as a kid,
yeah.
and B, than I've seen in the 15 years of growing grapes here. So when you have all those things going on, for sure, right? And I've been doing this for 15 years. We've got farmers around here that are second, third generation on a century-old farm, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, when I want to know what happened in the 70s, I go talk to those guys because they remember them.
Yeah.
And they know this place, you know, in terms of growing stuff here way more than I do. So you have to, in this business, it's agriculture first. We only get to make what we grow. And so you have to pay attention to things like that. But it's definitely out there. And, you know, the one thing you're always asked is, how do you deal with it? Well, unfortunately, the whole great business is about reacting to Mother Nature. You can kind of plan ahead and kind of make assumptions, but I'd be hard-pressed to have any weatherman tell you that a 10-day forecast is accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, we were supposed to be, today's Monday, we were supposed to have warm temperatures Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then it was supposed to dip right back down to minus, high minus digits, single digits, and we're above zero for the rest of the week during the days with very low minus, like minus three, minus four at night.
Yeah.
So that, and that's a week ago we're talking, looking at the forecast. So things are definitely here, and we just have to deal with it. And it's been like that. I mean, we can talk, you know, 2014, probably a typical season, 15 minus five on May 23rd or 24th, whatever it was. And then 2016, driest year in 50 years, right? We were in a drought from April till December, with Environment Canada saying that the Bay of Quinte was down so much that it would take five or seven years of annual precipitation to get it back up. And it took the summer of 2017, right?
Like,
So you have nuts. All these weather extremes.
Yeah.
And it just is what it is, but it's why we make wine, right? It's why we struggle to do it, because we love it. And when you can put something from a certain place in a bottle that defines a certain area, I think that's cool in a certain year, right? And a certain summer.
How would you, if you were going to describe Close and Chase to someone, like when I think of you guys, I think just classic Prince Edward County with the focus on Burgundy and Burgundy on Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and just a, you know, a high end Burgundy and keep saying Burgundy, high end Pinot and Chard House. That's kind of how I would describe it. How would you describe it?
That's probably a fair statement to say it like that. There's no doubt about it that when Deborah brought the concept of Closs and Chase to the partnership group, it was based on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. One, most likely because Deborah was known for Chardonnay, but also because it's the two varietals that almost every year get ripe here.
Yeah.
As long as you can control your yields, you'll get full physiological ripeness and you'll get a wine that has a sense of place. And we're very fortunate here in that, you know, reuniting the original farm in 2005, 2006, gave us two different terroirs to deal with. So that's why we're really focusing on single vineyard, because even though, you know, technically there's maybe 100 feet that separate the north from the south, vine to vine, the wines are completely different. And I think that's what Prince Edward County can do, is show different wines when it comes to Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in particular. But also, I mean, we've planted Pinot Gris here as well. I think it's another varietal that does very well here in the county. That's shows a very individual characteristic and style of the soil and the climate. And Closs and Chase, I want to be a leader in terms of putting terroir in a glass. So whether it's the Church Sides or whether it's the South Close or the Ridge Vineyard when it comes online, it's all about a year and a place that you can taste and will develop over time. And in 10 years, you can pull it out and say, oh my God, do you remember, you know, the minus five of 2015, and there was only 250 cases of this wine made, and we're very lucky to have one bottle of it because it doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
And that's, to me, that's what wine's about. And it's about having it with food, and it's about having it with friends and sharing it at special occasions and doing all those things. And when it comes to, you know, delivering an individual place, you get to know those. You get to know those places every time you work it, when you work in the vines and you work from the ground up and bring the grapes into the winery and respect the fruit and respect the place that they came from, and to respect all the hard work that goes into it, right? Because, I mean, hand labor here in the county is huge. That's why the cost to grow here is a little bit more than Niagara.
You guys handpicked?
Have to, yeah.
You know, right? For people who don't know, that's so much more expensive than
absolutely
machine.
Absolutely.
Now, you said had to. Why do you have to be?
Sorry.
You said have to.
Oh, you have to do more. There's mechanization is very difficult in the county.
Yeah. How come?
Because we have to hill up.
Right.
We have to tie down and we have to tie up, right? So
yep.
There's no machine that does that. There's mm-hmm. no machine that goes through and does cane selection and ties them on a wire. And, you know, we have 25,000 plants on each side of the road. That's 50,000 plants. And we tie down three canes. That's 150,000 canes that we tie down every vintage. So that's a lot of handwork, right? And it's all got to be done in accordance with Mother Nature. Because, yeah. 4 days ago, it was minus 19, right? And now we're... you know, yesterday was plus seven, right? Today's plus five. So, you know, the ground froze last week. And so you're constantly
I was supposed to come last Wednesday to do this interview, like around November 20th, 21st. And I got warnings saying, don't drive here. It's too dangerous, too much snow, and just not a day to come by car.
Right. And that's very typical of here. And, you know, there's years where we get a snowstorm that nobody else in Ontario gets, right? So you literally have 2 feet of snow here that when you were to go to Trenton back on the mainland, there's no snow.
Yeah.
And that's just of being in this beautiful place we call Prince Edward County. And it's because we got 2 extra feet of snow, it also means it's the whole reason that we can grow grapes here. As far as the comparison to Burgundy goes, it's always you know, we should be flattered to be compared to probably one of the greatest wine regions in the world, if not the greatest for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. But that's the extent of it, right? I mean, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are the only comparisons you can draw from in terms of Burgundy and Prince Edward County. Mm-hmm. The soils, although they're similar in structure, are different. Ours are older. Our aspect is different. We have minus 25 in winter. They freak out if they get minus 8. There's just all these things. And vine age. I mean, vines are old over there. So in terms of that, the comparison is that. And yes, most of the clones in Ontario are Dijon clones.
Dijon, yeah.
Or somewhere from within Burgundy. But I think that's where it ends.
Which sort of like, sorry to interrupt. The one thing.
Not at all.
And I find this a lot when I go to the States. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah, dog's licking my hand. By the way, people don't know this, but at some point, Kistler's literally almost licking your microphone as you're talking. It's hilarious. So many winemakers will want to tell you, and they'll say it 100 times over, we make ours Burgundian. It's more of a Burgundian style wine. And I always want to tell them, you're in Russian River Valley. You make Russian River Valley wine, but you're just trying to emulate what you can with Burgundy. But I always feel there's a level of insecurity with some wine, with it, maybe it's more the PR people than the winemakers, where they want everyone to believe that you're in the middle of Pommard right now. When it's like, no, you can take things from Burgundy, but we're New World. We're Ontario, Prince Edward County, or Sonoma. And that insecurity I always find remarkable.
When you think about it, right? I mean, there's the, if you think back to 76, right? Was the judgment of Paris, yep. and all that. And so, for the longest time, and even when I was going through sommelier school, there's no doubt that Burgundy is the epitome of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So,
agreed.
And I think what it is that we strive for the, I don't know if it's notoriety. Maybe it's notoriety. Maybe it's recognition. But the craftsmanship, mm-hmm. right? I mean, there's a general consensus that when you're drinking Grand Cru Burgundy,
you're drinking the best.
You're drinking the best, right?
And for you, so, with pride, you want people to think, when I drink a bottle of Clos and Chase, I'm drinking the best.
Yeah. And the
we
best.
We all want to feel that about our own profession.
And the best that defines this place, right?
Yeah.
Because we can't be Burgundy, and we can't be Russian River Valley, and we can't be the Okanagan, and we can't be Niagara.
No.
Because we're not there.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do is to be the best at what we do. And I think where I draw inspiration from is being like Burgundy in terms of saying where the wine comes from and trying to say that, you know, this unique site is special, and it's special because this is what the grapes do. And that's what they've been able to do in Burgundy. And I think that's the goal here at Clos and Chase. That's my goal as a winemaker.
Do we have the culture? There's a two-parter. Do we have the culture here in Ontario to try to educate and put more vineyard specific information on the bottle and in your messaging? Because, and I say this all the time, hell, this is the obligatory part of my number one thing I'd like to see for Niagara and Prince Edward County, is where this bottle of wine comes from this specific vineyard, and then people learn, oh, it comes from this vineyard, that means it's got more power. But this vineyard over here, it's going to be a little more delicate and a little more fragrant. And does Ontario, VQA, you guys do you guys need to do more to push that? And then the other side, do we have a culture that can understand that?
Well, absolutely. I think the knowledge or the desire to learn more about wine and specifically wines of place has increased dramatically.
Great.
I think there's more enthusiasm to learn about wine and learn about where the grapes come from.
Yeah.
Niagara's 30 years old.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe 40. Say 40 just for easy math, because that's 78. We don't know, right? Like you're looking at some places where, you know, you're onto second generation grape growers and you're onto maybe second, like home family wineries, like second generation winemakers who are just starting to learn what it is that these have to offer. And I don't think we'll truly understand the epitome of what we can do here for another few years. I think we're getting a grasp on it. I think for sure that we've recognized that Chardonnay is a varietal that we do really well here in Ontario. Mm-hmm. And as we talk about climate change and all those things, that the cool climate, the sense of acidity, the sense of place, that sense of balance, that electricity, those are things that we in Ontario will be able to do every year.
Yeah.
Right. Even in the hottest of years, when you look back at years like 15 or 2012 or even 2010, the wine still had acidity. And that's always our hallmark. And so when it comes to doing things like that, I think it's there. The LCBO, as much as we all criticize them, and actually I have to be, it's more about VQA Ontario. And VQA Ontario is definitely doing their part to help try and push that.
Yeah.
And I think that's good. I think we can drink local, but we also have one of the largest single marketers of wine and spirits in the world.
Yes, we do.
Next to Costco.
Yeah.
Putting wine in front of us, right? Yeah. And so it's there's a lot of challenge on the consumer to try and go and find all those local things.
By the way, now it's my turn with with Kistler. By the way, you brought up something I never even thought about, and just the most obvious point, because I love the idea of trying to, you know, identify the sub appellations, not just the appellations, but then I think I'm such an optimist, and I think I'm rushing to it about how specific vineyards, how they express themselves, but you kind of put it in the proper perspective. We're still so young. I think I'm getting ahead of myself, because you're right. If these areas are only 40 years old, it took, you know, France and Burgundy had hundreds and hundreds of years of a head start. One of the big things I wanted to talk to you about, because I heard this in an interview, what happened, because when did you join back? Because you were an assistant winemaker at Kloss & Chase. Yep. You left for a couple of years consulting, yep. And then you became, I think you were the winemaker in 2015?
2015. I took over for Deborah when she retired.
Yeah. And what's Deborah's last name again?
Paskus.
Yeah, Deborah Paskus, who was huge,
yep.
in Prince Edward County. I mean, that's one of the big names, one of the big pioneers. So, Keith, there you are. Congratulations. Congratulations. It's 2015. You're in control. This is a beautiful winery, great soil, so much potential. What happened on May 23rd, 2015?
We didn't have frost. Like, let's be honest. Frost is like minus 0.5 to minus 1, right? When when it got down to minus 3 and then minus 4 and it hit minus 5.
On May 23rd.
And we had shoots, right? So what happened was there's now frost fans in the vineyard. That's what happened. It was devastating. So first year as a winemaker, lots of nice green shoots, which should be a fairly decent crop after 2014. We were a little heavy in 14, but the plants looked nice. I mean, there were lots of old vines at that time. And then it just got cold, and there's just nothing you could do about it. And so that's why I say, like, 2015s for Prince Edward County are few and far between.
Yeah.
You know, anybody that did have a frost prevention fan, maybe 50% yield.
What did you guys have?
Off the south field, nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. Off 15 acres.
Wow.
Yeah. So Mother Nature can humble you very quickly.
Yeah.
And in those situations, there's not much you can do. I think that was the year that Vineland Estates rented the helicopter. And
you know, it's not just a, in this scenario in 2015, it's not just a Kloss and Chase episode. It's a countywide episode. I don't think there was anybody that wasn't completely untouched by it. Everybody had loss that year.
Yeah.
It was just varying degrees of loss. But in those years, you got to take care of your vineyard so that you get fruit the next year, right? I mean, that's the thing. You're always a year. The plants are a year ahead when you're still working in the year. So, you know, next year's fruit set was already determined this year.
Yeah.
So you have to try and keep the vines as healthy as you possibly can in order to give yourself every opportunity to get back to where you need to be much sooner rather than later. And that's what it's about. I mean, you know, it's a balance of fruit on the vine to time in the space in order to optimize your ripeness and get the quality level that you want in order to make the wine that you want to make. And here that's what it is. So we had a little bit of fruit off the church side that year. So, you know, I made 250 cases of Pinot and 220 cases of Chardonnay.
Yeah.
So,
and how much is in a normal year? How much was last year? How many cases?
On average, we'll probably produce off the estate roughly close to 3,000 cases.
So from 3,000 to
500.
To 500. That's just a dead,
In 5 hours.
Just you lose almost all of it in 5 hours in your first year.
And I can laugh about it 4 years later.
Yeah. Trust me, if we were doing this podcast, you know, in November of 2015, I would not have asked that question with that sort of flippant, casual style. I can promise you that. Keith, how'd you go from, I just loved a little bit about your story.
Sure.
How'd you go from drinking Blue Nun and Black Tower to making wine in the county?
The journey started in Kingston. I was introduced to wine literally when I first got into serving. And so I found it really interesting. I've always kind of enjoyed history and geography. So all those things kind of made sense. And then when I went to Toronto to work, I had an opportunity to do some part-time education. Mm-hmm. I was told no, that I could never be a sommelier. And so...
Why were you told no?
That's my interpretation. I guess that's my interpretation of the other end of the conversation on the phone.
Right.
And that I didn't have enough experience and that I could never know it all and that there was too much to know and it would
it would
take too much time and effort and energy. And so I've always been fairly stubborn, fairly bullheaded. So when somebody says no, I usually try and find a way to make it a yes. So I just put my nose to the grindstone and I started tasting, started going to LCBO tastings and vintage tastings and started working at doing stuff with George Brown, some part-time stuff and just became really interested in it. And I always tell it to new people when they start tasting is, you know, it's okay that your notes for the first year say green apple and citrus.
Yeah. Right?
'Cause that's what your palate is. And then when you start to expand your palate and explore new horizons, then your vocabulary increases and your knowledge increases and your olfactory glands are way more in tune. And that's when it really comes in part and parcel. But so through school, became a sommelier, was working in restaurants in Toronto. And then my wife and I decided that we wanted to move to wine country, having explored Niagara a couple times in the late 90s. Not when there was 150 some odd wineries, back when there was like less than 30. And so we just decided that we wanted to raise our kids in a rural environment. Mm-hmm. So read that there's this movement going on in Prince Edward County of people planting grapevines. And so we took a trip on a weekday. She was off, I was off from work. We headed down here and looked at houses and stuff like that. And I was 16, almost 17 years ago now.
2001, around there.
2002. Yeah, 2001, yeah. 2002. We started.
Yeah, that's a hell of a journey from there to here.
Well, and it has been. You know, it's been funny, and it's interesting because, you know, going back to what we were just discussing, and when I came back on board in 2012, I came back on doing retail and sales and events and stuff like that. All the things that were kind of the other half of the job that we'd started back in 2005, 6, and 7. And it just, when the opportunity came to be winemaker,
the new wave of people that had come into the county in 2009, 2000, between 2009, 2012, didn't know who I was, didn't know the history, right? So I always say there's like two waves in the wine, well, there's probably three, but really two significant waves in the wine business here in Prince Edward County, the guys in 02, 03, and then the guys in 09 and 2010. So nobody knew who I was. All the new people just, why would you promote a retail guy to be the winemaker, right? And
did you get hit with any sort of resentment?
Oh God, no, I don't think so.
That's good.
Not that it was said to my face. Yeah, I think some people were kind of maybe shocked for sure. But when you're offered your dream job, like why would you not take it?
You run to it
and invest your time, energy, and effort into it. And I had a good solid base, right? I mean, there's no doubt that I can't take anything away from what Deborah taught me, and I can't take anything away from my couple years away. I learned a lot, and I think, you know, the thing about being a winemaker is you're constantly learning because things are constantly changing. And I always say, you know, for all the things we know, fermentation is the one that we still don't know everything that goes on every minute of every time, and even the slight variations in temperature or placement or whatever the case may be can affect a whole bunch of different things. So it's you know, every year you learn, and every year those challenges make you think more about what it is that you want to do, how you want to do it, how you need to go about it. And also keeping in mind that this is business. I mean, there's, you know, if I don't make wine, retail doesn't sell it, right? And if retail doesn't sell it, then, and consumers don't like it, then
you can't make it.
We're not profitable. Yeah. And there's, you know, we've grown from, I don't know, like 6 employees in the course of a year to, I think in the height of the season now, we're up to probably close to 25, 30.
Yeah.
So that there's that on board as well, making sure that stuff is Kloss and Chase worthy. I mean, you know, Deborah built a great brand, and I'd like to think that I've continued along that way and taking it hopefully to the next level, putting some Pinots out there as well, letting people know that we not only were a great Chardonnay house and are committed to making great Chardonnay, but I'm also committed to making great Pinot Noir, and that's who we are, right? And then we're gonna have this fun varietal called Pinot Gris. So we kind of become a place where you don't have to think of us just as a Chardonnay house anymore, that we're making these two other wines, and, you know, we're starting down the road as sparkling as well. And all those things are good things to get us to where we have to go.
Where's that? Well, where do you want to be?
You got to be careful to say that because then people can hold you accountable for it.
Where would you like to be?
Where would I like to be?
Yeah, 2025. 7 years.
Like to have a better understanding of what's going on outside. I'd like to have a good continuity. Well, by then it'll be 10 years, right? 10 vintages. So hopefully people see that that we're consistently producing high quality premium wine. I want people to think of Kloss and Chase as the place they come in Prince Edward County to find out what the soil in the summer tastes like. Mm-hmm. That's what I want us to be. And not just me, right? It's not just me. It's my interpretation, but it takes a village.
Yeah.
And I want that village to also get the recognition that they deserve for it, as well as the place. I mean, I'm very fortunate in that, you know, we planted a lot early, and now we're starting to see what that comes out to be. I mean, we have vines that are 20 years old, but most of the vines are anywhere between the age of all the vines are older than 12 years. So, I mean, for here, that's young, but for here, that's a lot of old vines.
Yeah.
And so to be able to display that place in the glass, that's ultimately what Kloss and Chase needs to do. We've always been a terroir driven winery, and, you know, and we have a great terroir, and it doesn't mean that we're the only terroir in the county, because we're not. I mean, you know, there's 8 wineries on Clawson Road and 8 different sites, all doing, obviously doing some of the same things because we all do Pinot and Chard, but also some of us are doing some different things, and, you know, it can change in this 5-kilometer stretch. But Kloss and Chase, I think, is I want it to be, a place where people say, you know, the wines are really good and the wines really talk about where they come from. And they're well, the grapes are respected. I think that's probably what it comes down to. The grapes are respected so that the place comes through better than, well, not better, just comes through unique and shows this place.
Yeah, shows what
and,
it is.
And that's what it is. I guess, you know, I'd like it when people visit, they to say, we have to go to Kloss & Chase. I have to try the wine.
Yeah.
I want to sit and relax in the garden and just enjoy this beautiful place that's Prince Edward County and have a great glass of wine that, you know, tastes great now and will taste even better in 5 to 7 years.
Two last questions for you.
Okay, fair enough.
You said, well, because also, you know, we'll eventually get close to an hour and, you know, you have things to do.
That's all good.
You were in one interview I saw, you were talking about the difference between the culture of the wine culture in Quebec versus Ontario. Where we are, we're about 3.5 hours from Montreal. We're about 2.5 hours from Toronto. You're a little bit in the middle.
Yeah.
Between the two major cities of the respective provinces. Just curious, why are we so different?
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I think...
Or what are our differences then?
I think wine is part of the table in Quebec, right? I mean, yes, at least this is my interpretation. And then let's be honest, I mean, it's not going to be this way everywhere. But how I see it is that there's food and wine, right? Mm-hmm. It's always, not always, but mostly food and wine. And when I talk to chefs, they're from Quebec, they're generally in the food wine mindset. Quebec has a lot of French wine and they drink a lot of French wine. And we drink a lot of wine from a lot of different places. So I don't know. Maybe it's, I always just harken it back to, I never grew up with wine, right? I'm a kid who grew up in Kingston, pretty blue collar. Wine wasn't something that we did. Now it's become more, I don't want to say mainstream, but there's definitely an awareness of wine and food, and we're getting there. It's just, you know, when I'm there, it just seems like it's always part and parcel. It just seems that they have that connection, I saw the food scene in Ottawa change from, you know, 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006 to where it is today. It wasn't there when I first started doing sales calls, you know, as the assistant winemaker 12 years ago. And it's all come around. But the whole province has come around here too. So I don't know if we're that far behind. We definitely caught up a lot quicker. But I do. I just think it might be just cultural, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's not a bad thing,
no.
Because
we're not all going to be similar.
No.
Or should we be? How boring.
No. That's what makes us great, right?
Yeah.
It's the diversity of culture in this country that makes us who we are, and the acceptance of all those cultures, and you know, taking and listening and understanding, and taking all those things into consideration to help create our own identity. I think, you know, it's funny you say that. I think we, the Burgundy comment, I'm happy to be Canadian, and I think we should tout ourselves for what we are. You know, we've got Ontario, we got BC and Nova Scotia, a little bit in New Brunswick. We've got some great stuff being done in Quebec. I mean, we're growing our own grapes and making our own wine now, and I think we have enough international, we have different cultures in the country that allow us to now use what we grow here in terms of wine to pair with a lot of different foods that we have in our international culture. And I think we can explore that even further.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we, especially with, you know, the white wines that we do really well in Ontario, we do some really great reds as well. But nothing as big as they'll ever, you know, get in like they do in the Okanagan. And then great sparklings and the Tidal Bay wave coming out of Nova Scotia. So we're poised as a wine drinking nation, right? I mean, it's accessible everywhere. BC on the west coast, Ontario in the middle, and Nova Scotia on the east coast. Like I said, there's other places that are making wine too.
Well, those are the three.
Yeah, those are the three main ones.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, you have that diversity of each thing that is done the right way, and we're on the cusp of what will be, I think, potentially a really good opportunity, because as every cycle goes, you know, the ABC cycle, anything but Chardonnay, has kind of died down now, and people are drinking Chard again, because as a wine industry, we realize that there is such thing as too much oak.
Yep.
And so we kind of we've all been looking at how we can best express the grapes. But all those things come back part and parcel to put us in a situation where we can be on the forefront of leading cool climate viticulture in this country and in a lot of places. As everything starts to warm up, people are going to want acidity in their wines. People are going to not want to be drinking 14.5% alcohol wines all the time. Because that's, although we like sugar and we like glycerol and we like the mouthfeel, how much red meat do we really need to eat all the time?
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, you don't get me wrong. I love a nice California Cab or an Australian Shiraz and a nice big piece of red meat, but not all the time.
Yeah.
And so we're getting in there, and that's the challenge as well. As things warm up, sugars go up, which means naturally we're going to have wines that can potentially be higher in alcohol. So as winemakers, we have to make decisions according to that to best demonstrate that seam of acidity without jeopardizing what the vintage was, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
last question for you.
Okay.
What are your tasting notes of a 1994 Romain Saint Vivant DRC?
That's a long time ago, but it's
for listeners, that was one of the bottles that turned Keith into a wine fan.
That was the wine.
By the way, if that's not the wine,
yeah.
Damn, I wonder what's the one that is if it's not that.
It's Pinot, right? That's what it comes down to. And tasting notes? How do you describe it? You know what? No, Pinot, that bottle in particular.
I just want to know your memories of that bottle.
That's honestly probably life changing when it came to wine and understanding a varietal.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had the opportunity to taste a lot of California Pinots. Not a lot of Ontario Pinots were, I mean, we're talking 2001 back then.
The market now versus then were such
different. But, it's one of the greatest Pinots in the world, right? I mean, and there's a reason that scarcity for sure. But just texture, expressiveness. I've had the opportunity in my young life to taste some really good wine.
Mm-hmm.
A good amount of 2000 Bordeaux's, some great high-end Californias, some great Burgundies, some Unicos. I've had the opportunity to taste a lot of good wine, but no wine has challenged me to create that kind of effect where you literally have to stop just to appreciate what's gone on. I mean, when you nose it, I can still see myself doing it. So, you know, you're nosing this ounce that's all sediment and stuff like that. And it smells like, you know, earth and flowers and mushrooms. And you're like, okay. And you look at the color and I think there's one thing. Colors have definitely gotten darker in Pinot across the world. To have that color, which is, you know, more ruby than anything else, especially when you're used to big cabs that are black.
Yeah.
To have that, and then to have the experience of that delay where all the fruit was subdued, but all of a sudden it just dances on your palate, right? And when the texture is like velvet, right? Like, think, you know, I always say, like, take the mouthfeel of a really great Pinot is like that of a great chocolate. It coats your tongue, but dances ever so lightly, and it gives you all the notes, but doesn't overwhelm you. Tannic structure is light but complex. Finish is full and round yet vibrant and very whimsical all at the same time. It, you know, it dances like a ballerina dancer. It's very graceful and just takes everything to the next level and literally leaves you 18 years later going, holy crap, that was a great bottle of wine. So
that's a perfect, you know what? Drop the mic, my friend. You don't need to add to that. That's a perfect descriptor.
So, yeah. So no, yeah. And that's,
there you go.
And that's what, you know, there's a saying that says everybody who loves Pinot is always searching for that one great Pinot.
Yep.
And they've had it once and they're trying to recapture it.
Chasing that dragon.
And that's what I'm trying to do. Now, I'm very fortunate that I get to try and capture that myself. But, you know, that's the goal. The goal is to find that moment so that, you know, that I can relive it. Yeah. It's that simple. And allow others to hopefully have that same experience or a different experience that's life-changing for them.
Keith Tyers, winemaker for Kloss and Chase. Thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thanks for letting me do this.
I would recommend everyone come to the county, travel around, check out Kloss and Chase. Really, really pretty place to go drink wine. They got a little art gallery. They've got some nice outdoor space as well. And again, killer Chardonnay, killer Pinot Noir. I'm curious to try some of the Pinot Gris. Hell, after this is done, I'm going to probably go back to the wine tasting room and grab a couple bottles or something. So, Keith, really appreciate it.
Thanks for your time, Matt.
Hey, everyone, thanks again for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom, wherever good podcasts are sold. And as always, happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.